Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the managing editor at Crosscut. The impacts of climate change are already here. From record-breaking hurricanes to fires and floods, some communities are already in crisis. People living on the coast are especially vulnerable. A number of tribal villages in Alaska and Washington State, for instance, have either already relocated or may soon need to. Millions around the world are calling for climate change policies that will reduce emissions and prevent the most egregious effects. But in the meantime, is adaptation all we have? Crosscut invited a climate scientist and a climate adaptation specialist to discuss this new normal and the strategies we can learn from Native communities on the front lines. Amy Snover is director of both the Climate Impacts Group and the Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center at the University of Washington. Her work focuses on adapting and improving our resilience to climate change by using science to guide decision-making. Among other accolades, she has been recognized as a White House Champion of Change for Climate Education and Literacy. Michael Chang is the Climate Adaptation Specialist for the Macaw Tribe, whose ancestral lands spanned Washington's Pacific coast. He works with the Macaw on developing local, culturally relevant climate adaptation strategies, as well as with tribes across the Northwest and the entire nation. Crosscut Science and Environment editor Ted Alvarez moderated the discussion. This conversation was recorded at the KCTS9 studios on October 24, 2019, as part of the Crosscut Talks live series.
Okay, as we are talking about climate change in the Pacific Northwest, I think you could argue the most important thing is adaptation and resilience and how we're going to move into the future that we want. And so on the heels of all of this, we are very lucky to have two experts with us who both monitor climate impacts and work on helping us all build that future that we're hoping for. Amy Snover is the University of Washington Director of the Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center. And Michael Chang is Climate Adaptation Specialist with the Macaw Tribe. So really quickly, I thought I would just ask you to talk briefly about what you do at the Climate Adaptation Center.
Thank you. I'll talk until this catches. Okay, so thank you for the invitation to be here. As you mentioned, I direct actually two programs at the University of Washington, the Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center, which is a Department of the Interior funded center to look at climate impacts and to help natural and cultural resource managers prepare for those impacts. So we did the science on the local impacts and we worked with natural and cultural resource managers. And there's eight of these centers. They represent every state in the union. And this center is funded through the USGS and supports Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. It's part of a broader effort that I run at the University of Washington called the Climate Impacts Group, which has been working for almost 25 years to connect science and decision making to build climate resilience in the Northwest. And so again, it's a broader picture across more sectors and more interest areas and more types of governments than the Northwest Climate Adaptation Science Center. So we work with local governments and tribes and counties, states, feds, some private businesses to help them understand what climate change will look like, how it's unfolding right now, and we also enable action to prepare for those changes by developing the science that's needed and then supporting its use.
Great. And can you tell us a little bit about what you do, Mike?
Yeah, so I am the climate adaptation specialist for the Macaw Tribe. The Macaw Tribe is one of the coastal treaty tribes here in Washington State. Their main town on their reservation is Anaya Bay, which is one of the most northwest the most northwest point of Washington State on the Olympic Peninsula. Some history about the Makah tribe. They signed the 1855 Treaty of Niebe with the U.S. government, and in doing so, they ceded about 450,000 acres of their traditional lands to the U.S. in returns to maintain the right to harvest, gather, and hunt and fish on their traditional lands and waters. A lot of my work with the tribe is kind of twofold. So one is internal, so working with a lot of the tribal departments and the community on what does locally and culturally relevant climate resilience mean, and what does that look like at the local scale. And then I work a lot with external partners, including other tribes across the Northwest, in terms of advocating for regional resilience for tribal communities across not just the Northwest, but across the U.S. as well.
Great. So what I also want to do is I kind of want to paint a bigger picture for what's actually happening to the coastline. I think we hear sea level rise and you think of simply water levels rising, but there's a lot more than that. It's much more dynamic environment. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
So I'd be happy to talk about some of the scientific observations and the projections that we've made, and I'm sure Michael has things to add about what is being observed by the Makah or out on the Olympic Peninsula more specifically. So we are observing change across the region and in Washington in particular that it looks exactly like climate change. So the region has warmed, the sea level is rising, snowpack is receding, stream flow is changing, and all of these changes are in the direction that we would expect from climate change. They are not all caused by climate change yet. They're a combination of our natural climate variability and human-caused climate change. But as we look forward, we see much bigger changes in the picture, right? So far, sea level has increased. It's in Seattle. It's different everywhere across the state. So since the early 1900s, sea level increased a little over 8.5 inches in Seattle. As we look forward, sort of our middle of the road estimate for how climate change will affect sea level rise is it will see a little over 2.3 feet by 2100. That's a middle of the road scenario. It could be less, it could be more. We could talk a little bit about that range in the future in a moment. So sea level rise is one thing that I think people are fairly familiar with is resulting from climate change. There are all kinds of other changes that will unfold across the region and be important for coastal communities as well. So we'll see continued warming, right? No matter what scenario we look at, it's going to warm here. And we're on a path towards having the average climate by about the 2050s, the average temperature be warmer than the hottest years of the last century. We're on a path towards having higher rainfall events. So we're not expecting things to get wetter on average if you add up all the rain over the year necessarily. But when it rains hard, it'll rain harder, and that'll happen more often. We depend on our mountain snowpack for our drinking water and for cold water in the river for the fish, in particular the salmon that we care so much about. And with warming, we don't need to be a genius to figure that one out. There's less snow and it melts faster, right? So those are the immediate ways that climate change will affect our environment, right? Through sea level rise, through changes in temperature, through changes in snowpack and stream flow. There's been a lot of more work done to figure out why those matter and the impacts, and we can talk about those in a moment. But, you know, those all transfer in impacts for our forest ecosystems and our cold water fish ecosystems and our coastal ecosystems, but also our communities and our health.
So you brought up the range, and this is something that I think both of you can talk about. Like, when you're making these kinds of projections, the range could be, you know, a worst case scenario, a best case scenario, but you're still going to have to make decisions now or create tools that help make decisions now that are taking into account this variability. How do you do that, both from a tool perspective and then maybe, Mike, from an adaptation on the ground? How do you make sound choices when you aren't sure what the end result will be?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll begin with that. So we have gotten a lot better at helping people interpret the range of possible futures, right? So we don't know exactly what the future is going to look like. And we often give ranges. It might warm this much or that much. The sea level might rise this much or that much. And people say, well, why can't you tell me any better than that? Well, one reason we can't tell you any better than that is you can't tell me what society is going to do in the next 20, 30, 50 years about greenhouse gas emissions. And so how much it warms depends fundamentally on how much greenhouse gases we emit. So we have a choice. That's a whole big important point, is that we have a choice about how much change we see. But then even within, let's say, we pretend we know how much greenhouse gases we're going to emit, we still have uncertainty about the future range. And so in the past, we haven't been able to do much more than say, oh, you know, sea level rise by the end of the century, 1.5 to 4.5 feet. And you're like, okay, Amy, now, like, is it more likely to be 1.5 or 4.5? And what should I do about that?
That's like ankle or neck deep.
Exactly. So we're really excited because we, our team and a whole bunch of other folks did a big project this past year developing probabilistic sea level rise estimates. So we could actually say our, you know, middle of the road estimate that we say there's a 50% chance it'll be 2.3 feet of sea level rise by 2100 in Seattle. And there's a 50% chance it would be less, 50% chance it would be more. So we're really, you know, that one we're confident in. But the range, the likely range, you know, sort of like if, what is the most likely range, not just one number, that ranges from 1.7 to 3.1 feet. Okay, so what does that mean, 1.7 to 3.1 feet? So, demonstration. I'm 5'2", for people who can't see me, because this will be recorded. And 1.7 feet of sea level rise is just above my knee. And 3.1 feet of sea level rise is up at my belt. So that's the likely range of sea level rise. So that means, like, on average conditions, we'd be walking around the coast, walking around West Seattle, and we'd be, I'd be up to my knees or I'd be up to my waist. So that's a big range, but that's not, like, at my ankles, right? And it's not above my head. So that gives us sort of the middle of the road to plan for. And then we've also done some evaluations to say, what's the worst case? What could it be if the worst happened? It's kind of a lot. I don't even want to tell you. It's like 8.5 feet. But the point is, and I'm going to let Mike talk more about that. The point is, you choose the number to plan for based on what you're planning for, right? So if you just have a big old long lawn or driveway and your building or house is way up the hill, and you're just putting in, I don't know, a garden, and you don't really care if it gets flooded or not, you might just not really, you might plan for a low number. If you're building a million or several million dollar property, you might plan for the higher number, right? So what's your risk? What's at stake? And what do you need to protect? And so these new scenarios help people do that in a way that's really exciting, because we were not able to help people with that before, and they were frustrated and we were frustrated.
So how does that factor into, like, community level planning?
Yeah, I think issues around range and uncertainty, I think, have plagued decision makers for many, many years. And I think the work that the Climate Impacts Group and the CASC is doing around this probabilistic sea level rise is incredibly incredibly exciting. In my own experiences, I think there's kind of two different, I think, themes that emerge when we talk about climate adaptation. One is adaptation is needed when impacts have already occurred. It is often reactionary rather than proactive. And I think the way of having these probabilistic models is, how do we collectively become more proactive to impacts into the future rather than just being reactive to things that we see on the ground? And I think examples is issues of sea level rise. The sea has risen, and I think oftentimes collectively compounded with all these other events, such as more extreme winter storms, heavier wind and wave events that leads to flooding and washouts of places on the outer coast that have communities, homes, infrastructure that hold cultural significance. And so a decision like relocation that was shown in the video earlier is often, it is a strategy of almost last resort. It isn't the preferred strategy. The preferred strategy is to staying where you have built a home and where you have a connection for generations and generations and millennia. Adaptation is reactionary, and it's necessary in instances like that when you see the impacts that are already happening. So that's kind of the first category, is adaptation is often already reactionary to things that are already occurring. The other one is, how do you plan for the worst? And I speak for many coastal tribal communities on the outer coast of Washington. It isn't just sea level rise that they're planning for, but they're also planning for earthquake events or tsunami events that may occur. And so sea level rise may likely rise 1 to 3 feet in the future, or whatever the number is.
Not eight, definitely not eight.
But a tsunami will likely surpass that average range. And so when we begin thinking about, like Amy said, if we're relocating homes, community buildings, centers, resources, infrastructure, support systems for an entire community, we want that community to be there even in the most extreme events. So again, kind of on the opposite side of being reactionary is being extremely proactive in the face that if a tsunami event were to occur, we still want our communities and our support systems to be there post-extreme event.
So out of curiosity, not in specific, but what is something that can be employed in a coastal community that would make it resilient in the face of something like a tsunami that, you know, for an outsider feels overwhelming and terrifying? Like, what's a strategy, I guess, that a community might employ?
That is a very good question. I think, there are many different types of strategies. I think it's a different conversation when we're talking about emergency preparedness versus talking about climate resilience, though I think there is some overlap in that space. But thinking kind of where that overlap occurs, there are things that are explicitly emergency preparedness strategies. So kind of making sure everyone is aware of evacuation routes, kind of aware of supply centers or meeting points within the community that people can go to during an event like a tsunami or an earthquake. Kind of where emergency preparedness and climate resilience meet, it is kind of, where do we decide we want to put our new school? And the school might be where the meeting place occurs. And that, I think, has to account both where a tsunami may hit and also the sea level rise projections. I think working within communities, there's a lot of new research about what does social or community cohesion mean for the resilience of a community. So that is also both important within an extreme emergency event like a tsunami or an earthquake, and it's also important in the face of climate change as well.
We were talking before, and you mentioned certain traditional knowledge and almost native science that has been employed as proactive forms of resilience and adaptation. Can you take us through a couple of those? What they look like on the ground?
Yeah, so one of the things that many Native communities and Native peoples carry is, I think, the knowledges that is passed down through multiple generations. And I think there is a real wisdom in there in how this type of indigenous or traditional knowledge may inform how we are able to adapt or mitigate climate change. Some examples across the Northwest, one of the things that I've that has been covered in the news lately is this example of clam gardens that many Coast Salish peoples have traditionally used to both act as a source of food, so it provides both food security and sovereignty for these native communities, as well as acting as a buffer for storm surges, flooding events as well. There's many other examples across Washington State. The Colville tribe has utilized prescribed burning that has also been utilized by many forest practitioners from the tribe for many, many generations to help control wildfires.
That made me think of another example that I learned of recently from some of the other Puget Sound tribes that are using, you know, have used prescribed burn for a very long time to maintain meadows and to maintain conditions for first foods such as huckleberries to grow. And so now it's a discussion also as to how to combine those goals and those efforts with the reality of the increasing fire risk and needing to adapt practices for that.
And I think the Puget Sound tribes and the meadows, the camas, is an important cultural food. That makes me think of many tribes have utilized culture as almost like, I don't want to say like a framework that because that feels like super scientific, but kind of like as a framework of how do these native communities begin to address climate change and what does it mean for them? And I know the Umatilla, the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation actually has been pioneering a lot of this framing around first foods, specifically around water, around salmon, different types of plants and berries and roots, elk. And so I think that's also really important, not just what the climate impacts are, but how are we framing and communicating these within our communities as well.
Something that you mentioned that was interesting to me is that to solve or to adapt, a lot of these problems require several jurisdictions overlapping. There's municipal governments, there's, you know, DNR, Department of Natural Resources, all kinds of cooperation. So turning it back kind of to Puget Sound and the Seattle area, what is the state of the state when it comes to cooperation between those departments to kind of enact, you know, solutions?
So it's better than you think, but it probably should be better than that.
Okay.
Maybe I would say, or there's maybe more examples than people are aware of. And I'll just give a couple. There's a range of different collaborations and cooperations going on. It can be as simple as, you know, both the city of Seattle and King County manage coastal infrastructure around stormwater management and sewage treatment, for example. And a big question is, you know, are they planning for the same sea level rise? Well, yes, actually, they are. So good news, right? They're coordinating. They work together on this. They develop, you know, similar approaches to doing this. So that's one good example of just going that extra step to work with colleagues in another jurisdiction that you don't actually have to work with or maybe don't even work with normally in the course of your day to try to ground truth the assumptions you're making helps both parties feel more confident in the decisions they're making, but also helps all of us who live here be a little more confident that, you know, same planning is going on. Our team held a workshop last December looking at the increasing risks of wildfire west of the Cascades. And that is definitely an issue where cross-jurisdictional collaboration is really important. Where are forests? Well, the forests are in the city. The forests are in the counties and unincorporated areas. The forests are on DNR lands. The forests are on tribal lands. The forests are on U.S. Forest Service lands. The forests are on National Park Service lands. Right, it's the same forest, but it's all these different managers and owners. And so that was an early stage for cooperation and collaboration, for example, between emergency managers at the state level and local utilities in thinking about how do they plan for this risk. So, you know, there's examples of great important collaboration happening. There's other kinds of examples between scientists and tribal communities and scientists and data visualization folks and others. But there's, I'm sure you could all point out places where we need to do better. And that just indicates the fact that we have developed our systems of government around very particular issue areas. And we used to think that issues would fit in boxes. And you could have a natural resources issue and an ecology issue and a health issue, and each agency could handle it. And the problem with climate change and many of our other challenges is, of course, they don't fit in any of those boxes. And we don't have very good ways to work across boxes. So you can have it when folks know each other and reach out and say, hey, you're managing the coast and I am too, let's talk about it. But what worries me is how are we going to do that to scale and with the speed and the urgency that the complicated and fast approaching problems require.
You mentioned something, you know, anytime we can look for hope in this sector, we do. And you mentioned that the happy secret is how many people are working on this, which I think you spoke to a little bit. But I'm curious if you can speak to some of the other projects that are really exciting kind of in the greater Puget Sound or really all of Washington that stick out.
Sure. I'm happy to do that, and I will not share any examples from the coast so that Michael can chime in as well. But so to explain the comment, often, you know, I'll sit on an airplane and people ask me what I do, and then I tell them, and then they don't want to talk to me anymore. and I'm like, but there's a happy secret, right? The happy secret, and I bet it's a secret for many of you in this room, that there are a lot of really good people working really hard to understand and address climate impacts and the climate risks, the risks that climate poses to this place that we love so much. And people just don't know how much of that's going on. And that is the happy secret. Again, it's nowhere near enough. It's nowhere near enough. But a lot of people think it's zero. So one example that's springing to mind right now is I have a colleague who's in Washington State Department of Ecology. They have a toxics department. I call it the state Superfund program because it's toxic sites. They're not federal Superfund sites, but that the state is required to clean up and manage. And their job is to protect people and nature from those toxics forever. And she's said, well, gosh, forever is a long time. And the climate is changing. And a lot of these sites are on the shoreline, and they're going to be eroded with sea level rise. And a lot of these sites are on rivers, and they're going to be flooded out with climate change. And I don't think we're doing our job right if we're not thinking about those things. So she worked for a long time to finally, you know, get internal permission to do this. She developed guidance for her all planners and managers and designers and maintenance folks on these toxic sites and an atlas of where the risks are, and she's got the program to include this in their evaluation and planning. So that's one concrete, you know, sort of deep dive into an example, but they're all across the region, and I know that you have some to share too.
Yeah, I think in terms of the happy secret, I guess what gives me hope is, at least in the Northwest, and this isn't, I guess, to pat like ourselves on the back, but
it's okay.
I'll pat you, and you can pat my back, and yeah. We're not patting ourselves.
But I think the Northwest is often seen as a region across the country as a leader in terms of the conversations and dialogue happening around climate change, climate modeling, climate impacts, and climate resilience. And I think one of the things that is so incredible is just in the fact of how central conversations around equity and frontline communities are within this region. Tribes in Washington State and Oregon and Idaho have been leading a lot of the charge and the research around climate adaptation and resiliency for the region. In this past, the fourth National Climate Assessment was released last November. And part of the conversations, and it was explicitly one of the key take-home messages from the Northwest chapter, was the kind of disproportionate impacts that climate change has on frontline communities. As we know, climate change doesn't affect everyone equally, and everyone doesn't have the same opportunity to respond to climate change. And so the Northwest chapter specifically focused on tribal nations, the unique challenges they face, both from the risks to their natural resource economies, to their health, and how all of this compounds a lot of legacy of historical trauma to tribes. It talks about low-income communities of color within urban areas and how they face a different set of risks. And it also talks about migrant farm workers and how they also face a different set of risks. And each one of these frontline groups have a different set of historical, political, and administrative barriers for them to respond to the impacts of climate change. And I think a lot of that work has been happening in the Northwest, and I think a lot of people have been looking to us. So I guess that's both happy and like sad as well, but I think there's what we're doing here is we're talking about climate change. It's not affecting everyone equally, and everyone doesn't have the same capacity to respond in the same way. And I think people, the vast majority and the many, many people working on this issue in this region, that is at the forefront of our minds as well.
That's great. That kind of segues into my next question, which is, what is the average citizen's role in determining this future that we want to have? At what level should these lovely people get involved? And how? Basically, a custom plan for everyone in this room is fine.
All right, so the gentleman in the front row should pull out a pen and start writing letters, and the lady in the third row should... I firmly believe that every one of us has both personal and professional responsibilities and opportunities for addressing this issue. So, I mean, first of all, let's back up. Climate change, dealing with climate change, there's two sides to that that we can't separate, that we can't only focus on one. So we've been talking about adaptation, resilience, preparation, coping. We need to do that. How much we have to cope with depends on what we do about the first thing, which is what are we doing about greenhouse gas emissions? What are we doing about transitioning our economy? So, and I think it's kind of more familiar what we do about that one, especially in personal life, but also in the sort of energy and economic transitions that we need to have to move to a zero carbon economy. People, I think, aren't as familiar with what we might do on the adaptation and preparation side. And again, I really think there's a personal and a professional dimension to this. And personally, you can be an advocate for the need for this work to happen. The people that I mentioned, the happy secret people, are toiling away in obscurity. They are doing this, in many cases, without the support of their agencies or their higher-ups. I don't mean without the support. They're not doing it in opposition, but they're doing it without any extra support. And they would do a heck of a lot more if you stood up and cheered for them, if you said, this is what we want our public officials to do. You're making investments with my money. You're building our future in this region. Are you doing it with climate change in mind? Ask that question every time. And then when they do, say, that's great. You need to do more of that. So I have a particular example, the Okanagan-Wenatchee National Forest. It was in the early 2000s, I think, when they were going to revise their national forest plan, right? This is a like 20-year plan. How do we manage the forest? You begin with a lot of public meetings, scoping meetings. What should we think about in our plan? The public said, what are you going to do about climate change? It's a huge risk to our forests. They were the first national forest in the country to include climate change in their national forest plan. They did it because people demanded that they do it. So every time you go to a public meeting about planning, about investments, about anything, say, what are you considering about climate? Are you planning for the future or the past? And then professionally, it's really kind of the same thing, because climate change and resilience, all these things are going to touch every single aspect of society and every single sector we live in. So it doesn't matter if you're in education, doesn't matter if you're in banking. It doesn't matter if you're in the arts and want to help us understand and move us further forward towards this. Resilience matters to this, and so it's about taking a look about what assumptions you're making about the future and how you can plan more strongly and incorporate the knowledge of the fact that we are on a path to a different place. It's not a choice anymore. What do you need to do differently? We can all do that.
Yeah.
Did I rant long enough for you to...
No, I am like here cheering. I think everything you just said, I deeply believe in. Taking off, I guess, my like professional hat and putting on like my citizen hat, the one other thing I would say is holding our elected officials and our public agencies accountable. I think we are in this moment of extreme momentum around advocating and coalescing around climate change as an issue that we need to see action. And in addition to everything Amy said, I think it is to hold the agencies that serve us and the elected officials that serve us accountable.
Great. I'm going to go ahead and go to the audience question portion. Just open up the device. All right. Okay. So Fritz asks, who is going to pay for all of the dikes, water barriers, and structure required to hold the rise of the oceans back?
Sorry, can you repeat that question?
Who is going to pay for all of the dikes, water barriers, and structure required to hold the rise of oceans back? I guess, what is the...
There's a lot of stuff in that question, right? So when we think about dealing with sea level rise, there's only so long you're going to hold that sea back, right? So I think part of it is us... So when we think about preparing for sea level rise or adapting, there's the protect, right? This is the holding the sea back, build protection. There's the retreat, maybe some backup and give it some room. And then there's the abandon, which is just give it all up. And move somewhere else. And we're actually going to be facing all of those choices and all of those decisions as sea level rise continues. So who's going to pay? Well, that's a good question. There's a lot of private landowners. There's a lot of public landowners. And I think this is why I think, you know, climate change impacts will come home to roost locally. And many local governments are on the hook for dealing with these impacts in terms of protecting communities or protecting very expensive infrastructure. And this is why many local companies, governments are looking for support for dealing with these impacts from some of the causes of these impacts.
Yeah, I think one of the things if when we talk about this issue of relocation, I do think this question, I think, actually highlights where there are gaps in federal and state policies about relocation specifically. And this is actually an example that one of my colleagues gave recently in terms of relocation from flooding, storm surge, extreme events. Where if individual homeowners, whether they're native or not, if their home floods from an extreme flood or a hurricane or another type of extreme event, there are programs, federal programs, that allow for the federal government to buy back their homes. And I think when we begin talking about going to the film The Rising earlier, when we begin to talk about relocation of entire native communities and villages, there aren't any federal policies or programs that allow for the collective relocation or movement of these communities. It isn't no longer like, my house is no longer livable. It is, I need to move, but I need to move with my, my phone is beeping. I need to move with my family.
Sorry.
This all gets edited out. Don't worry about it.
It is, I need to move with my family, and my family may live in many, many different types of houses and homes near me. But if I want to move with my family, there aren't any programs that helps facilitate that relocation together.
Okay, here's another one. Is there any ability to work with or coordinate with BC government or Indigenous tribes of Canada's West Coast on this issue?
This issue, I'm assuming, means climate change. And I think there is a lot of opportunities for collaboration among U.S. tribes and Canadian First Nations. And so I think some examples there, I mean, I think there are actually many, many examples. Like many things, is they are often done without recognition and without a lot of fanfare. Some examples from Macaw specifically that I can think of. Macaw is actually the southernmost Newchalnith band. We're the only Newchalnith native group within the United States. All of the Newchalnith rest of the family is in British Columbia. And so when we work collaboratively with other Newchalnith First Nations, there is a lot of coordination around issues of impacts to culturally and commercially important marine species. And where does that mean in terms of movement due to changing ocean conditions? And so on that front, there is a lot of transboundary planning. I think another area is this issue of oil spill preparation, preparedness, and response, that there is a lot of coordination, not with just Canadian First Nations, but also with many of the Canadian counterparts in terms of planning for increased vessel traffic, especially within the Strait of Juan de Fuca from the Trans Mountain Pipeline that will be put in. And so I think on oil spill, again, is not explicitly a climate change issue, but when we think about oil spill risk with the risks to other things that climate change will increase in the future, these are all kind of interwoven issues that many tribes and First Nations are actively thinking about and actively working together as well.
This one's kind of a personal one. Recognizing that we are newcomers to this geographic area, what is your personal interaction with the land? What is your experience with these places?
Recognizing that I'm a newcomer here, this is where I grew up and has where, as a child, spent most of our family's free time outside in the mountains, hiking and skiing. And so I thrive on understanding both in my head and in my heart how the ecosystems of this region and our, you know, sort of natural climate, how all of that works. And that's why I do the work I do here, and it's intensely local and is intended to help, you know, connect the scientific approach to creating a tool for foreseeing part of the future and foreseeing the implications of some of our actions so that we can act in a way that will have the impact we desire. So connecting the science to appreciation of the place that I live and is a big part of the reason I am who I am.
Yeah, I think that's such an important question, not just within the context of climate change or the environment, but just I hope that everyone carries around with them, is I think oftentimes when we think about tribes or native peoples, we think about them in the past as like a history issue. And in fact, it's quite the opposite. There is, as we've seen in the video earlier, as we hopefully know, by being here in Seattle and the surrounding areas, that there are many, many diverse tribal and native cultures still alive and thriving today. One thing in terms of, I would also say, not only just the land, but I think one of the lessons that I have learned within this line of work is that you can't really separate the land from the water and from the air, right? And so when we think about when you think about moments of acknowledging not only the land we're on, a lot of the philosophy and the worldview of many Native peoples is that everything is interconnected, right? And we need to treat it as such. And that also applies, I think, in a lot of the climate work that we're doing as well.
This is what I'm going to kind of combine to. Do you engage with any youth, and how will you educate them to about these issues? Basically, either do you interact with younger people, or do you know of, do you have colleagues, et cetera, who do in ways that are really exciting?
I think I think that is a fantastic question. Being able to work not only with the Makah tribe, but across many tribal communities, I think one of the ways, the most important way that I see many tribal communities as seeing as a resilience strategy is education and engaging the youth into this issue. There was a study done by the Swinomish tribe, and they had asked their tribal members, out of all of these variety of impacts or different types of strategies, what is the most salient issue for you? And far and away, the most salient issue in terms of climate change was education. And so I think that is really true for every single Native community, not just within the Northwest, but across the United States. And so I think in many, many different forums, Indigenous and Native forums that I've been in, youth has been central to the planning and to central to those types of events, whether that be highlighting youth leaders in this climate change movement, whether really investing and getting youth to these events to learn and engage in these conversations. And I think part of that is because these are issues that we're dealing with now, but they're the future. They're the ones that are really going to be feeling these impacts in 2050.
I really like what you said. It's underneath, if I heard you right, a lot of those comments was also about making opportunities and helping enable youth to have a role in how we address this and how, you know, what our priorities are going forward, and helping ensure a sense of agency for them. I get very impatient with calls for educating kids about climate change because they really ought to know and they're just the voice of the future. Because also, in my experience, the kids know this already. I think they wish that we were more educated about this. They're carrying around a lot of pain and anxiety, and it's an incredible burden that they're carrying right now, and I think it's very irresponsible of us to hand it to them and to think that we're making the difference by doing simply the educating. I think we need to be finding ways to help lift that burden if we're not just sharing it, which is the kinds of things that you were talking about, which is inclusion in the response so that they can see that they are not the only ones who want to make a difference on this issue.
In any circumstance, evacuating from your home is very traumatic. How is this amplified in cases of tribal sovereignty and U.S. recognition of finite borders?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. I said this earlier, relocation is not a preferred strategy. It is not a preferred climate adaptation strategy for anyone, let alone many Native communities, because of the multi-generational relationships that they have with the places that they are in. And so I think in terms of... there's just so much there in terms of making a decision to relocate is not taken lightly in terms of a tribal's community's own decision-making and ability to determine their own outcomes. One of the things that we always say is relocation, it doesn't have to be a unanimous decision. I think oftentimes tribal communities and governments have this expectation that isn't placed on other government counterparts that it needs to be consensus-based. And relocation is an extremely contentious issue within Indian country. And so these are all different types of considerations. In terms of sovereignty and recognition, I think there are very... clear examples currently that are happening that demonstrate how sovereignty and recognition may impede a community's ability to relocate if they have decided that's the avenue they go. So I think in the example, one that jumps to mind is the Ile de John Charles down in Louisiana. So it's a Native community that relocated to... essentially one of the barrier islands down in Louisiana. And the reason they relocated there is because of a lot of the anti-Indian policies in the early 1900s and mid-1900s that relegated many Native peoples to either boarding schools or places where schools were available and resources were available. And oftentimes those were away from their Native homelands. And so not only did when I talk about historical legacy and trauma, not only did these policies force many of these Native communities to relocate there many decades ago, now because of climate change, they are now needing to relocate again. And so in terms of recognition, the Ile de John Charles is not a federally recognized tribe. So despite... being recognized for their for being one of the leaders in terms of utilizing relocation and doing so in a community-driven way. Because of their recognition status, they have not been receiving the support that they need from their federal and state partners in terms of their journey to relocate their community. So... it's a really deep, thoughtful question. I think it's a really difficult question to ask. And I think specifically around relocation, it's hard to talk about because it does open up a lot of wounds that still exist today for many tribes in this country.
I'll end on one that it's the question I probably get asked more than any other. So how much of an effect do individual actions like recycling or composting have versus advocating for bigger policy change?
It depends on how you're measuring your impact, right? So this is the conundrum of climate change, right? We're all in this together, and yet none of us can fix it. And so, and to really, you know, to stop temperatures from increasing, we have to transition to a world where we take as many greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere as we put in every year. So we have to fully transform our economies and our energy system. So now you tell me the best way to do that, right? I mean, that's systemic change, And some of it goes through political action. Some of it goes through demonstrations. Some of it goes through, innovation and entrepreneurship. Some of it goes through, I transformed my life and now I walk everywhere and I inspired five other people to do that. And they now are feeling empowered to make a difference in the world. So they start changing their behavior and they become politically active. It all matters. I would just suggest that you do more than one or the other, that it's a yes and.
Anything to add?
No, that was a great answer.
I think that's a great place to end. Thank you so much to our guests, Amy Snover, Mike Chang. Thanks so much for coming tonight.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and Victoria Ralph and produced by Sarah Bernard. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And if you like the show, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It really helps other people find us. For the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. And remember to save the date for the next Crosscut Festival, May 1st and 2nd, 2020. To learn more, go to crosscut.com/festival. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.